Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Suppose it's all true, and you walk up to the pearly gates and you are confronted by God. What will Stephen Fry say to him, her, or it?
I will basically, what's known as theodicy, I think, I'll say, bone cancer in children? What's that about? How dare you? How dare you create a world in which there is such misery that is not our fault? It's not right. It's utterly, utterly evil. Why should I respect a capricious, mean-minded, stupid God who creates a world which is so full of injustice and pain? That's what I'd say.
And you think you're going to get in
on
that?
No, but I wouldn't want to. I wouldn't want to get in on his terms. They're wrong. Now, if I died and it was Pluto, Hades, and if it was the 12 Greek gods, then I would have more truck with it, because the Greeks were... They didn't pretend not to be human in their appetites and in their capriciousness and in their unreasonableness. They didn't present themselves as being all-seeing, all-wise, all-kind, all-beneficent. Because the God who created this universe, if it was created by God, is quite clearly a maniac, utter maniac, totally selfish, totally... We have to spend our life on our knees thanking him? What kind of God would do that? Yes, the world is very splendid, but it also has in it insects whose whole life cycle is to burrow into the eyes of children and make them blind. They eat outwards from the eyes. Why? Why did you do that to us? You could easily have made a creation in which that didn't exist. It is simply not acceptable. So, you know, atheism is not just about not believing there's a God, but on the assumption that there is one. What kind of God is he? It's perfectly apparent that he is monstrous, utterly monstrous, and deserves no respect whatsoever. The moment you banish him, your life becomes simpler, purer, cleaner, more worth living.
Heresy shouldn't be this much fun, but it is. It just is, especially when we get to kill God, or at least give him a nice kick in the cojones, which will be our topic today. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am your pompous of gnosis. Some people maybe call me Maurice because I'm the space cowboy. I don't know. I might be the only person who ever quotes Steve Miller in the entire internet. But I never said I was well in the head. But I welcome you, everybody, and so happy to see everyone on this Friday. I hope you're having a good holiday season, and I hope you're staying warm, especially those of us who are up north. So, yes, today we'll be talking to an individual whose book I really enjoy, and that is Alan Bondar, to talk about his book, How to Kill God. Alan, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Pleasure is all ours. And with us, too, we also have the God Killer, Moondog Vance. Vance, how are you doing?
Oh, pretty good. I say slay a God every day, you know.
Indeed. So y'all got to get Nietzschean on your ass.
Yeah, there's so many of them.
Flat circle. We'll be doing this. Yes, I know I'm quoting True Detective again. I can't help it. I can't help it. So awesome. Well, good to see everybody going into the chat. Hey, Graham, good to see you. Hope you're having a good Friday. Hello, Bradley. Hello, Sean. Hope everybody's doing well. As always, if you have a question for Alan or a complaint for Vance and I, please super chat them so we can get to them. Please support this show in any way you can. Become a sub, one-time donations through PayPal, Stripe, YouTube. I even take crypto. No, I do not take the hawk to a meme coin, but I do take crypto. And if I know these are hard times for so many people, like, subscribe, tell your friends, spread the word about AM Byte. It helps to keep the lights of the pleroma on. Yes. So,
Do you take Moon Doge coin?
Yeah. I guess I would. Yeah. So, very cool, Alan. So I really enjoyed your book, and I think the part that kept jumping out at me in the first part was you were saved several times, right? I thought it was only once, but somehow I thought I grew up Catholic. I thought there was a lot of loopholes and I used those loopholes, but there were some loopholes with you being saved more than once. Tell the audience about that.
Well, you know, in Christianity, I mean, I guess it depends on which view you hold to or which denomination. Some would say you could be saved and lose your salvation and be saved again multiple times. I suppose I did grow up in that mentality with my family, though I don't know that that view particularly ever took with me, because even pretty early on when I started thinking for myself, it was a once saved, always saved thing. But it was more just either I didn't connect the dots early when I first became saved, you know, and then later it made more sense. And I was like, oh, yeah, I really do want to be saved now, you know, whereas maybe early on it was just because my sister led me to the Lord. And, you know, you want to be saved. My sister saved, you know. So when you're at such a young age, you consent, but maybe you didn't understand it. So as I got older, I understood it more. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. Sure, I'll raise my hand. And then, of course, the other story with the being baptized, you know, in the Church of Christ denomination, that's kind of a requirement for salvation. And, you know, I had to get the gospel right and get baptized to get to heaven. So that was kind of like the third time and I had to do it. So yeah, I kind of went through them all and I got to experience it all. But then, of course, you know, later on in my theology, I came to conclude that, well, I think I was always saved because, you know, God called me from my mother's womb. So,
it's like a Dragon Ball Z. Saved, yeah. Super saved.
I picture Mario Brothers, you know, with the mushroom. I don't know, man. But yeah. Yeah, so it was like that. It was like that. But yeah, then after that, it just took, you know, I wasn't, once my theology was right, well, at least in my opinion, right, I didn't need to do that anymore. I was good.
Good deal. Good deal. Yes. I enjoyed your book, eh? Because intellectually I enjoyed your arguments, your research, but I also thought it was a very poignant and inspirational book. And it, of course, reminded me of my upbringing and the upbringing of so many people, whether we're in religions, political systems, you know what I mean? But tell a little bit about your life and how you evolved from a pastor to a free thinker.
Sure. I appreciate your thoughts about the book, though. Thank you for your kind words. The journey from pastor to where I am now, is that what you're asking?
Yeah, or your journey, just a brief summary of your life trajectory from, again, becoming a theist to a free thinker.
Okay, well, I grew up a theist. Didn't know any different. Didn't think any different. Right. Never crossed my mind. You know, and as I get older, you face these horrible atheists, these misguided idiots that know nothing about morals and all they do is eat children.
Of course.
You know, so, you know, that was my take as well. Long story short, I grew up always passionate about the Bible, always passionate about studying, went through many avenues of theology and many, many denominations. You can read about it in the book if you're interested. Mm-hmm. Whoever's listening. I won't bore you with all the details. It's much more exciting in written form, I think. But anyway, so I journeyed through and eventually came to an understanding of something called preterism. It's a theology that teaches that all things in the Bible were past fulfilled. Mm-hmm. So we're not waiting for anything future, no future second coming of Christ, that the all the descriptions of the end of the world weren't about the end of the world, but at the end of Israel's world, the destruction of Jerusalem and the fall of that old covenant system. So it's all couched in metaphors and stuff that would actually bring it to an end through via the destruction of Jerusalem. So that the coming of Christ was his permanent dwelling with us forever and evermore. So right. That was basically the gist of it. So that's where I landed, and it made the most sense of the Bible to me. Still does.
I still
think that it's the best understanding if you're going to actually interpret the text. But from there, just continued to keep studying. And of course, you know, just over, you know, decades of putting certain views behind me that just weren't adding up, I was undoing layers of brainwashing and I didn't even realize I was doing that. So I put this view behind me because I was like, that didn't make any sense. And then that view behind me because that didn't make sense of the Bible and that didn't work. And then, oh, how do you prove God exists? Well, none of the apologetic arguments work. They all fall way short of proving God exists. You know, Because at the end of every one of them, you know, when you ask somebody, how does that prove that Yahweh actually exists? Well, you just have to have faith. So, I'm still encountering that today. And it's very, very frustrating. You know, that's basically the ultimate answer. Well, you just have to have faith. And I know that that's always going to be where it goes because there's no proof for God. So anyway, you know, I became a presuppositionalist because since I couldn't prove God existed, I just had to take the stance of, well, God just does. Get over it. that's essentially what it amounts to. I mean, obviously, it's more eloquent than that, but that's what it amounts to. So that's where I ended up. Presuppositionalism, preterism, had a reformed view. You know, God's sovereign. He controls everything. And because of his son, nothing can affect me because there's no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. So that was my whole nine yards stance. And then after all these layers of brainwashing, removing, making sense of the Bible and seeing things weren't making any sense. I had a friend named Michael Loomis. He used to run a radio show, really awesome online radio show. So for the preterist movement, And he came to me and he started sharing with me some of the other myths and that were, you know, the Bible was based on and started highlighting all those and pointing them out. But at the time I was still a Christian. So I had the information right in front of me and it was like right there glaring me in the face. But of course, well, you know, God just preceded it. And, you know, he made these other things come first just so that
the old Tertullian argument.
Yeah. But, you know, eventually that haunted me, too. And these songs were always in the back of my mind. But, you know, I just refused to let go of God. A lot probably the reason because I had a church that I had planted as a preterist. And I was married to a Christian that, you know, at the time, you know, I remember, you know, you can journey anywhere you can with God. But if you ever become a non-Christian, you know, that won't work, you know. So, you know, that was always a scary thing. Not that she would have left me because she loved me. And we had a great relationship and all at the time. But it was just that kind of stuff. Like you're like, ooh, what would happen if I can't? So you just kind of suppress it. You never really allow the real deep question of does God really exist? Even plant in your mind. You just, nope, it's not an option. Of course, once I lost my church, got divorced and all that happened, you know, I was still a Christian and I still kept seeking God. I still kept begging him to reveal himself and forgive me for all of the horrible things that I did. And I just, man, I wanted to have my relationship right with God so bad. And all I could ever contemplate was being a pastor again. Like that was my life. That's all I knew. Like that was my identity.
Why did you lose your job? Or you?
When I got divorced and everything, there was a whole lot of circumstances there that I had to.
Right.
Didn't have the leadership to take over for a while. And I just wasn't in a good state of mind to run it. So I just shut it down. I had to, it was just the right thing to do. And anyway, so it's a couple years later, I've been going through therapy. I'm, you know, going through Christian therapy, secular therapy, everything I can think of, because I was a mess, you know, when you get divorced, it's not an easy thing.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, losing your whole career, it's also not easy. Yeah. But at any rate, not that it wasn't somewhat my fault. I mean, there was plenty of blame to go around. It wasn't like anything like that, but we don't need to go into those details. But the bottom line is here I am, lost everything, depressed, you know, but recovering. Going to therapy, starting to heal, still trying to seek God. Can't find him. You know, I'm meeting with people and they're asking me questions like, how's your walk with the Lord? And I remember I'm like, what does that even mean? Like, I used to ask that question too, a lot of people. And then here I am sitting on the other side. I'm like, I don't even know what that means. How's your walk with the Lord? Like, you know, so I know that that's just a, you know, it's just a nice way of saying how's your belief in God, how's your strength, how's your faith, you know, but that was really, and I knew that. And so I started contemplating, how is my faith? Like it was completely shooken because God wasn't there. And I used to go on prayer walks every day, prayer runs even. And just talking to God. And it was just one day, I was out walking, doing my prayer walk and literally mid-sentence, I just stopped. And in the silence, I literally said to myself out loud, what am I doing? I'm talking to the air. And right then in that very moment, that was it. That was literally the end for me. I said out loud following that, I said, I'm an atheist. It was just like that, night and day, just instantly, right then and there. It just, that last piece of brainwashing just disappeared when I realized I'm literally talking to an invisible friend like my nephew who is six. I, I couldn't believe, I was like, what am I doing? That was it. That was the end for me. And it just made, ever since then, like I was fine. Like no demons, no angels, no God coming down to talk to me. I was free. It was amazing. I didn't have any more fear of this sin that I was offending God and going to go to hell. I was like, wow, I can actually do what I want now. I can literally do what I want and have no consequences if I do something that's going to harm people. But, you know, within reason, right. Obviously, I'm talking about genuine things that aren't, you know, harmful to others. Right. There's still that as well. I mean, I'm not a denier of morality and stuff, but and I talk about that in my book as well. But here I am, you know, finally, for the first time in my life, thinking I'm free. And all this time I thought I was free as a Christian.
No.
But that was a prison. I couldn't believe it. I could not believe I was in a prison of the mind that made me think I was free when in fact I was in prison. It was wild. So that's the long and short of it. That's how I ended up where I am here.
Good deal. Good deal. Yes, as many in the audience know, I went through a brief period where I was a born-again Christian. What most people don't know is my conversion. I converted through the Children of God. And if you know who the Children of God, it's a very intense, fundy sect of the 70s and 80s who would convert men through sex. Now, it didn't happen to me that way. I was in a crisis. My cousin was in the Children of God, and it was a traditional conversion. It wasn't what they did, which sleep with men to convert them. But she said, we just sat down, you know, it is. We got on our knees, pray to Jesus, enter you, and boom, I felt great. The problem is it only lasted for 3 months because cognitive dissonance was too much because they were so apocalyptical. And I would ask questions like, wait a second, so after the book of Revelations, are we just going to stand around in New Jerusalem with the golden streets? I was like, is that it? That's not a good movie. And they'd be like, oh, no, we'll have superpowers and we can fly to other universes and convert other races. I was like, okay, now that's a little bit, I can go, I'll do Marvel Jesus, sure. But it didn't work. So after 3 months, I was like, nah, you know, but I did enjoy the rush, you know what I mean? The Jesus is in my heart and
yeah,
he'll take care of everything. And in a way, it was good because it got me out of my ego where I was like, oh, you know, stop stressing, you know, everything's going to be okay. I liked that part, but I didn't like the rest. So that was my brief conversion story.
Right, right. Well, all placebos are great.
Yeah, they work. They can work. Yeah. For sure, for sure. And so for your book and the topic of your book, which is fascinating, is you equate these religions as a sort of mind control. You even say the word mind virus too. What's the mechanism in which they control people as soon as you're born, or like me, when you're converted and they start putting all that stuff in your head? How is it like mind control?
I mean, look, when you grow up in America, and I can't speak for other countries. I've talked to people and some of them say it's similar. Some of them say it's way different. All I can speak is for America. And when you grow up in this country, let's face it, God is everywhere. And I don't mean that God literally is everywhere. I mean, the idea of God, the word God, you can't escape it. You grew up with it. Even if you aren't raised in a Christian home, I am certain at some point in your life, you heard, God damn it. Right? I mean,
my dad was an atheist, but he said that every 5 seconds.
Right. I mean, and why? I mean, where did we come up with that? You know what I mean? Like, it's a strange statement. It's only because we're inundated with God. And so it became a curse word, you know, whatever. So you can't get away from it. I mean, God, we trust, you know, you go to court, you put your hand on the Bible, you swear on the Bible. You know, it's like, what is that going to do if God's not real? Like, it's so ridiculous. Every president's a Christian, you know. In the end, every speech and God bless the United States of America, you know, every star and football player is a Christian. And except, you know, there's some that aren't, but like, there's so many that are just so inundated in our culture. It's to such a degree that it's almost irreverent to suggest that God is not real.
Right.
You just assume it in our culture.
Right.
From the highest levels down. Now, there are some who are lucky and they escape it early on and they have parents that aren't Christians. And so they're very fortunate that it isn't driven into them the Christian ideals of theism. But theism is still something that is just naturally embraced. And even the atheists probably had at some point to contend with that concept, who would become an atheist, I would imagine. Yeah. And I did. I don't know how many out there that weren't Christians first that did, but I'm going to guess they probably had to contend with the whole theism thing. So I think just naturally, we just assume God. Some people escape early, but the majority of Americans are Christians. Let's face it, they are. I mean, even if you're in the Catholic sect, you're a Christian, you know? So it's just what it is. And it's similar to, and I'm probably going to go here in a second, so I'm not going to say too much about this, but I parallel it to other addictions, like smoking, for example. Right. It's much the same way. You know, we're inundated with all of the polarizing aspects of how great this drug is, because you see it in all the movie stars and it looks cool and it's portrayed as positive. And so you become brainwashed to think this is great. This is a wonderful thing. And so of course, like, you see people that you respect smoking and you're like, well, that's odd. I mean, why would they smoke? They're smart. If it's so bad for you, you know, why would they smoke? Here you are, you know, you're smoking. So, same, you look at people you respect and you're like, well, why are they smoking? Right. So it's like this whole, and so it's easy to fall into the trap of thinking that this is a wonderful thing. And then once you're stuck, you're stuck. Mm-hmm. And once you're brainwashed, it's so hard to break free of any addiction. And I equate that to Christianity. I think it's exactly the same thing. Some people fall into different religions, but most fall into the Christianity version. And it's all over the place, obviously. And I'm sure you'll have a question about that at some point, but I'll turn it back over.
Yeah. You talk about they have their own version of the Trinity: fear, shame, and emotional dependence. And of course, that's a hard one, right? Because you always assume it's not, let's say, you leaving. Yeah, there's a fear, the shame, all that. But you also assume, well, there's my social net. There's where my friends hang out, my parents. This is the people in my town. Will I lose it all? And that's always that's a big fear.
It is. And, you know, on a much smaller scale, I can parallel that and say, so Christians are, like, one of their greatest fears is, if I leave Christianity, I will lose this whole network of fellowship, of people. But if you parallel that to smokers, right, and that, especially that smoke actual tobacco, cigarettes, during your break at work, what do? Y'all go out together and you all smoke the damn cigarettes, you know, and you talk and you laugh. You have a great time. That's your fellowship. That's your group. And you go back outside and you go back to work. If you stop smoking, what happens? You lose that camaraderie because you don't really feel like you want to be out there with that smoke in your face and stuff. And then you're losing time at work and your mentality changes entirely. So you wouldn't say, well, I'm just going to keep smoking because I want the fellowship. No, once you break free of that, you realize how free you are. You don't want to go back to that garbage. So it's the same type of thing here. So I understand the fear. Unfortunately, it's on a much larger scale, obviously. And so you think you're going to lose this gigantic network, but really, you can build the same type of the term fellowship comes to mind because that's what Christians use, but the same type of community outside of the church. It just takes a little bit more work on your part to go out of your way and make friends. The church just makes it easy because it's a big monster. You know, it's gigantic, and it makes events and potlucks and, you know, worship services. And, you know, so it gives you something to go to. And because you have a common interest, it's easy to make friends there. But sure, once you break free of that, obviously you're going to possibly lose some friends. Hopefully not. I mean, hopefully you have more connection than God. But most of the time, that's pretty much your connection at church. And it's
Yeah, I can relate. I mean, when I went into rehab and I became getting over cocaine and alcohol, of course, it was in my head. What about my friends? What about the nightclub, the bars, you know, the camaraderie at the bars? I lose that. And then you realize, well, A, it's got to be done, or my sanity is on the line. My life is on the line. B, if I lose those friends because I've changed, then we probably didn't have that sort of deep bonding, because something like that should not. Friends can hang out in different ways, you know. So
yeah, no, for sure. And I mean, and let's face it. I mean, in the reality is, it is not just a religious thing. You friendships are always based on commonalities.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it works. And even if you really do admire each other and you are genuinely friends, if you lose several of the commonalities you had, it's just really hard to just stay in contact with them. It is. I mean, it's almost becomes forced, like, oh, we should keep talking because we're supposed to be friends. Right. I mean, let's be honest. That's just the way it is. Once you lose common. And so I have some friends like that, and, you know, every now and then we'll touch base and we'll pick up like we never, you know, like we never left, like right when we left off. It's not a big deal, but we don't talk all the time because our commonalities aren't the same, and that's okay. It's just reality of life. It's not a Christian thing. But it is going to affect you if you leave Christianity. Sure. Of course. But it's no different than leaving a job. I had really good friends at my last job. I went to a new job. We don't talk anymore.
Yeah. You lose touch.
We could if I called them. It was not like we're not friends, but we don't have the same interests. So that's just life. It is not a religious thing or an addiction thing. It's just life. It's the way it is in every aspect.
Yeah. We move, you evolve, we grow. Vince, do you have a question? I'm going to let that out while you ask the question. Cause they're like,
yeah. I can see the dependence aspect of, you know, Christian sects and any religion, but what do you think the difference is between a dependence and addiction? Because with an addiction, I feel that it's harming yourself and others. Whereas a dependence is just something that you're using as a crutch to survive. So what's your view on that?
Yeah, I would not draw a distinction between them. I think they are one and the same. I think if you have a dependence on something, it would be the same as an emotional or a social addiction. So it would be almost like maybe gambling would be an example of a social addiction versus a substance addiction. When I think of God as a religious addiction, a dependency, I think the concern I have with it is that you are depending on something that doesn't exist in order to push off the responsibility that you should have as a human being. It is much easier to blame God or Satan, my invisible friends, for the decisions that I made that either was good or hurt somebody, because I don't want to have to face the responsibility if I made a decision that was harmful to somebody. So I don't know that I would draw a distinction. So that's the way I would classify the word dependency. Does that mean it's bad to be dependent sometimes on certain things? No, because I depend on my doctor, for example, to give me medication for things that I need medication for, or to give me a diagnosis that I can't, you know, figure out myself. So I think being dependent sometimes on others is good, but a dependency, it almost like, I guess I would say that crosses the line into being something you can't survive without, because you think you need it when you don't. I guess that last qualifier is how I would make the difference. When you don't, that's a key aspect. So I need a doctor. That's different than needing an invisible friend. It's different than needing a puff of the cigarette. I don't need that. That's just harming me. It's a dependency because I think I need it, but I really don't. I don't know if I answered your question. Hopefully I did.
Yeah, you did. I don't see it that way, but that's your definition. That's fine. The other thing, here's the big question. What is it? What God don't you believe in? In other words, what's your definition of God that you no longer believe in?
Well, funny you asked that, because if you ask any theist to define God, nobody can. So I don't know how to answer that, because I would have stumbled over my words even as a Christian if you asked me that. I'd have been like, well, and I would have given you the, you know, Westminster Catechism answer. God is a spirit, infinite, eternal, and unchangeable in his ways, you know, blah, blah, blah.
But even that's not true. Even so, I mean, Dan McClellan on his show has shown that there is no one God in the Bible. There's many.
Sure. He's all over the place. I mean, There's no consistency with God. I mean, trying to follow God is like chasing a moving target. You can't follow anything. He makes a rule and then he breaks it three chapters later. Like, you're like, what are you doing? So even when they start out, God is a spirit. Like, even if you stop there, just the very first word that defines God in the Westminster Catechism, it's like, how do you define a spirit? Can you define it in such a way that if I experienced it, I would know I experienced it? Well, no, I mean, you can't, because you can't. Like, that's it. There's no define. All you can talk about to define God is what he isn't, not what he is. because everything you say that he is makes no logical sense. There's no foundation for it. So I can't personally define God. I can only say that there are so many definitions of God that the only way I could define him in my book is to say that God is an idea. That is how I define God. He's an idea. And because he's an idea, he's different to everybody that thinks of him. May I ask you, Vance, just because I'm curious, since we're in interaction, how would you define dependency and distinguish it from addiction?
Oh, dependency and addiction? Like I said before, an addiction is something that's overtly harmful to either you or other people. Like if you think about alcoholism, drug addiction, so forth, you're destroying your body. You're engaging in underground activities that are, you know, criminal in many cases. You're hurting those around you because you're depriving them and so forth. And, you know, people that come out of addiction can tell you very well. Whereas a dependency is usually just something that's personal to you, even if it's imaginary. Like little kids have imaginary friends. When I was a kid, you know, I was undergoing a lot of trauma, and I had kind of an imaginary friend that really helped me. And whereas there was no other help around, but it didn't hurt anybody. It was just something that I used as a balm, so to speak. So that's my definition between dependency and addiction. I mean, all addictions are based on dependency, but not all dependencies are addictions. I mean, we're all dependent on food. We're dependent on companionships, more or less, you know, depending on the person. So,
right,
you know,
right.
That's the way I think of it.
I see. I guess my quick response to that would be that if you have a dependency on an invisible friend called God, I'm just going to stick with that specific example. It actually is very harmful, not just to you, but to others in this way. Think about this. If I'm a pastor, I have a dependency on God. I trick other people into having a dependency on God, even though I don't think I'm tricking them. I think it's genuine. And then I convince them to give me $400,000 of their money over the course of 50 years to something that has no bearing on life whatsoever. I take them away from their family for 10 to 20 hours a week because they have to serve in a ministry and serve in be in a small group. And destroying, you know, taking father's time away from their kids because of this. I have a friend who said that, you know, when she was a Christian, you know, she couldn't tithe because she didn't have the money. And the pastor told her, well, since you don't have the money to tithe 10%, give 10% of your time to the church. And so she started doing that. And she sacrificed so much time with her kids that she regrets it to this day, that she lost, because she would do kids would say, can we do this tonight? No, I have to go serve in the church tonight. Mm-hmm. So a dependency can actually be very, very harmful. And I think that's the equivalent of an addiction in my
experience. Holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands, from fragrances to accessories and the latest styles. Discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
Opinion.
Oh, yeah. I would call that an addiction. If you are stuck and because of your beliefs into following, in fact, following is often addiction. It's the following that I think is the addiction. That's a social dependency too, because you're afraid of being rejected by your peer group and so forth. Then I think that would cross into addiction. I'd agree with that.
Oh, sure. No, absolutely. And you use the word fear. And I think the bottom line is the only reason people stay as Christians is fear. They're afraid of what life will be like without their invisible friend and without their community at church. So they continue to just believe and have faith, whatever that means. There's no understanding of it whatsoever. There's no reason to believe. You just believe. But they're going to stick to it no matter how much logic shows the opposite. But they're just going to stick with it because they have a great fear of what life is like without God. And because ideas like hell for a lot of people have been so inundated in their minds, I can't leave this because what if I'm wrong? And the irony is at that point, it's not even faith anymore. You're living by Pascal's wager, which if that's the case, then you're not even going to go to heaven anyhow, because it's not faith. it's a wager. You're just rolling the dice and saying, well, I'm just going to claim to believe in God when I really don't, but I'm going to say so just so I don't go to hell. The whole thing is nonsensical. But anyway, to your point, yes. So I would say fear is a key factor. That's why they continue to just follow.
Oh, yeah.
Because of that. So, yeah.
Well, that I make a distinction, though, between belief in some kind of higher power, not necessarily defining it as the omniscient, and all that, the things that, you know, that churches tell you that God is, belief in that, and then becoming addicted to an institution or being afraid, you know, I believe because I'm afraid I'll go to hell. And that's something different. But for me, now I don't want to be preaching my own gospel here. Not that I don't sometimes, but for me, it's clear to me that existence has a basis of some sort. There is some source of existence and source of intelligence in the universe. And that's why I say there's big A atheists and little A atheists. The big A atheists say, I know there's no such thing as any higher power. It's all material. It's all physical. And it's all glands and atoms and so forth. And like the scientists say, and the small A atheists say, well, I don't believe in the God of the Bible, you know, the big Jupiter guy with throwing the lightning bolts and sending me to hell and all that stuff. What do you think about the big A versus the little A atheist concept that I just put out?
Well, I mean, sure. I guess I would, in my book, I distinguish them as Gnostic atheists versus agnostic atheists. Right. You know, the Gnostic is the one that's definitively making the claim there is no God. Okay. Well, if you're going to make that claim, then you got to back it up. And now you have the burden of proof. I don't think there's a God simply because I see no evidence for it. I have not found anything to substantiate the claim that there is a God. So I'm still waiting for that. And I think, you know, centuries of attempts have failed to take us to the finish line. So I'm just, you know, at a point where I'm like, I have a hunch we're not going to find any. So maybe we just need to move on and stop believing in God. But, you know, as far as the big A, little A, you know, is there a possibility that something intelligent or some design, whatever is out there and something created this? I don't know. I'm an agnostic atheist for that reason. I think we have to figure out what it is, or we don't have to. We like to. We like to try. But I think not knowing isn't the same as filling a gap just to feel comfortable. We as humans love to know the answers. And so if we don't know the answer, we just want to plug it with God. And that doesn't work. Like, why plug it with God? Like, this whole concept of God is so weird to me now that I'm on this side. Like, it made all the sense in the world when I was a Christian. It's the only possibility. And now I'm here and I'm like, that possibility is not even sensical. Where did we come up with this idea? There are so many possibilities we haven't even yet explored, probably, that could be the answer. And it's much better to wait until you have evidence before you believe in something, rather than just to believe in something because you don't like not knowing. A few minutes ago, behind Miguel, I saw his cat there running behind there. And I thought to myself, as you were talking and the cat was running, I thought, huh, big A, little. I was like, maybe the cat back there is a starter of this universe.
He thinks so. He definitely believes that.
Yeah. Right. I mean, our cat thinks so, too. Maybe all cats were. Maybe a uniformity of cats figured out how the hell do we know whether they did or not? We don't. We aren't certain. And as long as we're not certain, we need to leave the options open without making a definitive claim that this is it. And the problem I have with religion is it makes a definitive claim that this is it. And that definitive claim is not based on evidence. It's based on faith.
Some atheists could be said to have that. The big A atheists, for example, could be likened to a religion also, because the big A atheists are associated with scientism, physicalism, and so forth. And so if you go according to science, that's its own religion, and which doesn't have real hard evidence as to how the universe started. They call it, oh, the singularity before the Big Bang. But then 20 years from now, they'll say something else. So what do you think about that, about scientism and so forth? And
well, I think that making a definitive claim as an atheist has now moved beyond the realm of atheism. And that's a big problem I have with the big A's. Like I would consider myself a humanist as well as an atheist, but I would not say that atheists are humanists. I would say most humanists are probably atheists, but I also can't make that claim. No. They're distinct things. Atheism isn't a thing. It isn't like the only reason atheism is a term is because theism is a term. Like, as long as people believe in God, there's going to be atheists because we just deny the evidence that is supposedly put forth by the theists. So I'm not claiming any belief system. I'm not a scientist. I'm not anything as an atheist. I don't believe in science as an atheist. I don't care because atheism isn't a thing. It isn't a belief system. We're not walking around huddling and, you know, proclaiming our atheist flags. Like, and if they are, you've now changed atheism into something it isn't. Big A, little A doesn't matter to me. Once you start saying, I believe this, now you've moved beyond atheism.
It's another belief. Flying spaghetti monster. Right. Do you have any flying spaghetti monsters in your house?
Right. So, I mean, I may have a lot of beliefs, but at that point, now I'm categorizing myself as something else, which is fine. But I would not say that's a form that is an expression of atheism in any way, shape, or form. It isn't.
Yeah, I think my dad was what you call a classic atheist. I call him the true atheist. He was like, without God, without religion. In other words, I'm not going to talk about religion. I don't want to speculate on God. I'm out of the game. Don't bring it up to me. My mom was Catholic. I'm going to live my life in this material world, and I don't want to hear, think, or avoid religion. And that's how he was. And he didn't start trouble, but he also didn't accept trouble either from theists. So I think that's the, and later on in life, he said, well, I speculated there's some sort of intelligence or ground of conscience, but that's all he said. That was his one speculation in 75 years. But the rest of the time, he was just a classic atheist. But Alan, what about the idea of trauma? Because obviously, it's even if, you know, it seems you're happy, you're free. I'm sure we all have trauma from our Orthodox religions. I think mine was the fear of hell until I learned about purgatory, loophole. And I was like, oh, I love purgatory because that means I can screw around a little bit more in this world and I'll be just washed. But a lot of people, you would say, still have trauma. Did you have trauma and how did you work it out if you did it?
Bro, I'm still working that out.
Yeah, because an addiction, sometimes there's no cure. You just got to keep, working on therapy.
Well, yeah, I mean, the damage it does to your minds, especially Christianity. I mean, if you think about it, if you actually, I was so passionate about believing 100% what the Bible taught. That's why I kept journeying and figuring things, because I just wanted to know so bad what God's word taught. Like, I just, nothing mattered to me more than knowing God. Like, it was, and that's why I get so angry with Christians, like, especially family members that tell me, you were never really a Christian. I'm like, are you freaking kidding me?
No true Scotsman.
It just drives me nuts. I'm like, you have no idea how much I just loved God. And like, it was passionate. I just wanted nothing more in life than to know him and to follow his word 100%. To the degree that, like, if you do actually follow God's word, it teaches very clearly. This is the one thing that I can say, and I know everybody says it clearly, but there are verses that say, you know, your righteousness is as filthy rags, you know, and it translates as menstrual rags, you know, you're that right. Wonderful, you know, and there's no one good, no, not one, you know, you're such an evil sinner that just even the slightest white lie you are deserving of eternal punishment. And that's why God had to send his son to die for you. And, you know, you imagine listening to that garbage when you're 9 years old. You're such a bad person that God has killed his son for you. Well, that makes you feel wonderful. You know,
that's abuse. You don't tell children that.
Well, yeah. But apparently as Christians you do, and it's wonderful. We cheer it on. And even today, you know, when I'm an atheist standing opposed to that, Christians will look in my face and be like, oh, you're just an immoral, godless person. I'm like, really? And you're the one telling your children this shit? So, like, yeah, so I grew up, that was my life. That's all I cared about. And I built that mentality into my mind so much that all I needed, my dependency, Vance, was Jesus. That was it. Without him, I was a worthless worm, worthy of nothing but eternal damnation. I had no value in and of myself whatsoever. Every single ounce of my value was found in Jesus. And that is a glorifying concept in Christianity, because as long as you live to the degree where Jesus is the only thing you need, because without him, you're nothing, that elevates the glory of Christ. That is the mentality of Christianity, if you actually follow the text. Fast forward to becoming an atheist, you now lose Jesus. Where does that leave you? Worthless, nothing, worthy of nothing but eternal damnation. You have no value in and of yourself, and now I have nobody to find value in. Holy crap. So yeah, it did some serious damage to me, and I'm still in therapy working that out, finding value in who I am as a human being.
Yeah, the deprogramming. Yeah.
And if anybody says to me, Christianity isn't harmful, yeah, it is. It is absolutely harmful, and I want to get people out of it. That's why I wrote this book, because it is damaging people's psyche. It is damaging people's lives. It is damaging their personhood. It is devaluing people. It's a terrible religion. It's a cult worse than probably any of them.
But there's what, 45,000 denominations?
Yeah. And you get that from the World Christian Encyclopedia. I mean, obviously, it's kind of like a rounded number, but the way they get that is that they looked at all of the, not only the major denominations, but all the minor sects within the denominations and all the breakdowns. And so if you look at every single one of the differences, you end up with about 45,000 different denominations. So it's not just a thrown out number. It's actually pretty close to what they've evaluated based upon all the different sects. That's crazy, isn't it? Like 45,000. And yet God's not the author of confusion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's why I like ancient Christianity, because there was about 45,000 sects until the church took over. It was a pretty wild religion and pretty wild rituals and everything else. Isn't Derek from Myth Vision, was he a preterist too, right? Or he was in the same denomination you were?
Yes, he was. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. Derek and I come from the same cloth.
Exactly. And it's pretty fundamentalist. I mean, again, I like, it's like you said, it makes sense that Jesus fulfilled everything. You don't have to worry about deciphering the end of the world and when Jesus is coming back. But was it pretty fundamentalist other than that?
I would not call it fundamental. Not by really? Any stretch of imagination. No, it would probably be, though there would be some that would be fundamental. And so preterism in itself doesn't dictate whether you're fundamental or not.
Right. How literally you take the Bible.
But I would say it's probably the furthest point from fundamental. I guess let's clarify what you mean by fundamental. Because when I think fundamental, well, go
ahead. Yeah, I think of taking the Bible literally, strict rules from the Old Testament, not drinking, women have no rights, gays have absolutely have negative rights.
That's what I'm thinking. No, that is fundamental. And no, we are. No,
oh, okay.
Yeah, no, you're going to. Though again, you will find some like that in preterism, because they're not associative. It's not
right.
And that same idea. But most preterists you're going to find have broken free of that way before they even became preterists. That's how they even were willing to journey. Because I mean, think of it, if you're a fundamentalist and you're willing to just like buy into that, you're not even allowing yourself to venture into a sect of Christianity that's considered heresy, you know, and preterism was, you know, that's like a heresy, you know, you're stepping outside of Christian orthodoxy, you know? So yeah, no, it's definitely, most people can't really stomach fundamentalism if you're a preterist, I would imagine, yeah. at least the ones that I encountered.
Right. For sure. For sure. And what do you think are some of the worst apologetic arguments that are out there? Again, your book does a great job, lists all the sections and all that. So the one I would like to bring up is the one of Star Wars and the Force. And I guess because it really goes back to defining God. You know, Alan, Miguel, and Vance are going to define God completely. Everybody in the chat room is going to define. Is he the ground of consciousness? Is he Yahweh? Is he like consciousness put together? Is he the quantum foam that has ripples? Is he, it's almost impossible to define God. So
yeah, I can't define it for sure. I have ideas about it. I have feelings about it. And
we all agree it's cat. So maybe we should start our own religion.
Yeah. It's funny you say that when I, my work, everybody knows that, you know, my history and stuff. So we created a whole religion at work as a joke. one of my coworkers brought in a little stone, and she colored it in and made a person out of it, and we call it the Rock. And so we create a religion called the Rock. You know, we study it and praise it. And anyway, it's just silly. I don't even know why I just brought that up, but it made me laugh at thinking about
Dwayne Johnson. No,
well, yeah, I mean, I guess right. That's a joke, but it's like it's not Dwayne Johnson. It's the Rock. But you know, it just all started with this whole, you know, we're going to get stoned later, you know, with the Rock.
Yeah. And you even have a scripture that says, let he is without sin cast the first stone, right?
Exactly. So we just have all kinds of like funny stories about it, but I won't go into that anymore. But yeah. So anyway, so the point is, yes, everybody can create their own God however they want to. And you can't ask two Christians to define God and then define him the same way.
But that's what I was saying, because if you see the Bible, it is an evolution of thousands of years. So there's different conceptions of God. There's the tribal God. There's the God that was El. Oh, no, but in this section, he's more like Baal. Oh, here's God with the philosopher's God, where Hellenistic, theology. So he's omnipotent and divine and transcendent. Oh, no, but he's actually Jesus. So there's a lot, and you know, in some parts of the Bible, God is not omniscient, he's not omnipotent, he's not omnipresent, he's more of a tribal God of the Bronze Age. So that way, from the Bible, and I'm glad, I was raised Catholic, because we were not sola scriptura, so we didn't have to die on that hill, right? It's we knew the Bible was wrong. It was not a problem when you're Catholic or Greek.
Lucky for you. You know, I still encounter Christians like, and I get this, I still get this on the reg, and it drives me nuts. Well, the reason you're not a Christian or whatever you're arguing for is because you didn't experience God the way I did. You don't know the God that I know. And I'm like, okay, define the God you just have to experience him. How does that help me?
And how do you do it? Does he give you like steps to, you know, this is how you have a mystical experience? No. Yeah. If he said, okay, do this, smoke this, do this.
Right. But it's crazy because everybody has their own excuse and their own religion and their own experience. And I'm like, who do I turn to give me the correct experience? Well, this one says, well, it's me. I'll give you. This one says, it's me. I'll give you. Everybody says, it's me. I'll give you the correct. and I have people, well, I hope you turn back to the Lord, you know, my family. I hope you turn back to the Lord someday before you, you know, you suffer the wrath of God, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, tell me then how to turn to the Lord. Like, what does this mean? Yeah. Like, explain your God to me in a way that I can actually believe it. Because right now I find no evidence for it and I don't believe it. So what you're asking me to do is pretend like I believe it, right? Like, because I can't, like, I would love to believe it if you could just demonstrate to me that he's real, and how you come to know him.
What about one of the other big arguments is the idea of theodicy, you know, and that's what religion tries to work through is, why is there evil? Why do bad things happen to good people? Why do certain weather patterns destroy towns? Why, you know, so evil is something that religion, of course, struggles. What do you tell people? Well, what about evil, Alan? What do I do with that?
Well, I guess the first thing I say is, why does there have to be a reason?
No.
I mean, you're making a big leap to assume that there has to be some cosmic reason for evil. There doesn't. Who says there has? Like, where did we come up with this idea that it has to be explained? Like, there has to be some cosmic reason. There doesn't. All that comes from this idea of God. Well, and it's a presupposition. Well, in the back of their mind, since God exists, he gives a reason. So I'm going to trap you and say, there has to be a reason. And that reason is God. Well, that's not logical reasoning. There really doesn't have to be a reason. Maybe it just is. That's just the way the world functions. I mean, evolution doesn't give us an answer. In fact, the universe doesn't give a shit about us. They don't care about us. We have defined, we have determined as a human race that we're valuable and that we're going to be moral with each other and care for each other. Like that's, and that we're valuable. That's our decision. We did that. The universe didn't give us that. We just chose to do that. And some God certainly didn't do that. So, you know, I would say that, you know, first of all, there's no reason to think that there has to be a reason. There really doesn't. But even that being said, I know that the typical response from Christian is, oh, there's evil everywhere. God has to deal with it. How can this be a problem? Well, no, God doesn't have to deal with it. We deal with it every day in the justice system. I mean, evil is dealt with. there's a big distinction between sin and evil. And that's the problem Christians have, is they don't know that there's a distinction. They think sin and evil are the same thing, but they're not. You know, sin is an offense against God that is, you know, worthy of eternal damnation because you do it once. And so God has to mete out punishment for you offending him. That's sin. Sin doesn't exist. God doesn't exist. You know, if one needs the other. So, if, you know, if neither one of them exists, then you don't need each other. You know, evil, that's different. Good also is a good thing, you know, as a thing. So, you know, they counter each other, but yeah, so we do our best to live out morally so that we will make good decisions and not evil decisions. And those who choose evil will be met out by the justice system of whatever society or culture that they're a part of. I was watching a show today, and I thought it was quite fascinating, the discussion they were having about morality. The guest on the show, who is a Christian, was trying to argue that they are unable, they don't trust their own moral ability to determine right and wrong because they're such a sinner, and that's why they need God's word to determine it. And so God is moral, and he's wonderful, and so we just trust God and do exactly what he says. And the question was asked, if you don't have your own moral compass to determine right or wrong, then how do you know that God is actually moral? And that was a great question. I was like, that's brilliant. And the dude couldn't answer the question. He just kept circling around. He didn't want to answer it because if he conceded to that, then he has to concede that he's the one making his own decisions for morality and not God. But he refused to concede to it. And that's the problem with Christianity. They don't want to concede to the fact that they're living a life of faith in something that doesn't exist. Everything we've done all of our lives has been made by our own decisions. We are the ones doing it, not some invisible friend inside of us.
Yeah, for the audio version, I'm putting a quote by Stephen Fry, and he has a great line that he did on TV, and they ask him, well, what if you went to the pearly gates? And he starts with, no. First of all, atheism is I don't believe in this God. Second, there is a second factor. If there is a God, I'm going to chew him out. He's yeah. Like bone cancer in children, you know, storms, all the things. You're in charge and you effed it up. So in other words, he says that's the second part, that just in case I meet God, it's not like I'm not bowing down to him. I'm going to punch him in the face.
Right. Right. No, I totally agree. I mean, if I was Abraham, I'd be like, you told me to do what?
It didn't work out. Yeah. Moses didn't make it to the promised land. Yeah. With friends like God, let's stick with Satan.
Exactly.
I think you're on mute, Vance.
Yeah, that was before the Ten Commandments, right? When God told Abraham to kill his son. So that was okay.
Yeah. Well,
Ten Commandments weren't in effect yet.
Yeah, right. I mean, I won't even go to preterism, because I would argue as a preterist that it was actually available in the garden. But we'll leave that. That's
right, nice. Right.
Yeah. You were making a joke, so I don't even know why I brought that up. That's funny. Yes.
Well, Vance, do you have a super chat or a question? I got another.
Super chats, both from Crossover Maniac, and so I'll put up the first one. He's just basically he or she is just basically sharing. That his mother tried to instill the loving, merciful God model on him. But when he read the Bible, he saw the God of wrath with no mercy. And that, I guess he's referring to the Old Testament mainly. So he believed in the worst one before, and then he lost his faith. And then he also said, and this is another a take on something, the Catholic Church doesn't technically believe in sola scriptura, but that never stopped them from bashing you with the Bible verses if they think it backs up their claims. That's not so unlike true. Protestants.
That's so true.
But I could hit them back too. So. Yeah, that is true. That is true. But there is a lot more loopholes in Catholicism than in the Protestant religion.
Well, it's all arbitrary is the problem. It's like, go to any church, Catholic, Protestant, or other, it doesn't matter. It's all arbitrary. It's whatever that church wants to push down your throat or believe or hold to. I mean, it's all preference, you know, it really is. You know, even the things that you get punished for that you, I remember I got church disciplined for arrogance once because I was teaching a view that everybody in the class didn't accept. And I told them, I still think I was right. And they told me that was arrogant, and they put me on discipline. I was like, are you serious right now? I'm confident in a view that I hold, and it's called arrogant. Like, everything's construed as arrogance just because you're confident. Anyway.
Well, didn't you get in trouble for the Apostles' Creed?
Oh, yeah.
Letter? Yeah, that, yes. I couldn't believe that. I had to reread that. Tell the audience about that.
Yeah, yeah. I was not allowed. Well, it's how I lost my job as a youth pastor at one of my churches. It's also how I was not allowed to finish my seminary degree. Because, you know, in the creeds, with the statements, he shall come to judge the living and dead. I believed he has come to judge the living as a preterist. And we've already talked about that in this episode. So that one word change from shall come to has come cost me my seminary degree. They, you know, they took all the, they didn't care about all the classes I had already finished. They didn't reimburse me. They just said, oh, you're not allowed to finish. And that was that. They just let me finish my class. I was only seven classes from my seminary degree. And that was that.
Jesus.
Yeah. And the irony is, I went to school with other friends who denied that Jesus descended into hell, which is a part really? Of the Apostles' Creed.
Yeah, yeah.
And they were allowed to continue on because apparently it's arbitrary and that view doesn't matter as much as has come or shall come. And I was like, that's not fair. I was like, why are you guys dictating which part of the creed is okay to deny and which one isn't? But my request fell on deaf ears. It didn't matter.
Human fallibility.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of it's institutional, don't you think? I mean, all these religions, they're attempts at groups of people to develop a common model of the universe, as flawed as it is. And there's so many, you know, exceptions and hypocrisy and so forth. But it's a groupthink thing. I mean, it's the same thing as with patriotism in the United States or any other, you know, group, or scientists with their group of, you know, perhaps evidence-based, but nonetheless, group thinking. Do you think it's a group think versus individual think issue?
I mean, it depends. In a lot of churches, they have the whole, Presbyterian model where they have an eldership. And so they think through things together. And if you have a good pastor, he's the kind of person that genuinely recognizes his inability to always know the answers. And so they'll bounce out and come up the answers together. So yeah, in that sense, it's groupthink. In some churches, you know, the pastor is just the one who dictates whatever he studies, he believes, and that's the way the church goes. So that's not so much groupthink, unless you consider the fact that he's also studying other resources. So maybe that could be classified as groupthink. I don't know. But maybe by and large it is.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we're getting towards the end here. I see another super chat. Let's check this one out. Are most Jews atheists? Well, I don't know how to answer that. I don't know if you can. I mean, in Judaism, you can be a cultural Jew and be fine. I mean, I don't know the statistics. I mean, I know in my family, I have cousins and uncles who are atheists, but they're still culturally Catholics. They go to mass. They go to parties. Simply, again, they want to be part of the Portuguese community, so they play along. But they're very obviously loud after the party at home, saying that I don't believe in God. So I'm assuming it's the same thing as Judaism. You don't get kicked out. But
well, I mean, if you're an atheist, you sure get kicked out of Christianity. I don't know about Judaism.
Not Catholic. I'm saying not in Portugal. It's not, and in Judaism, I don't think you don't get kicked out. You're still part of the.
Interesting.
The people.
Interesting.
Awesome. Well, as we get to the end, what do you want people to get out of your book, Alan? How to Kill God.
The Easy Way. How to Kill God the Easy Way is the name of the book. The bottom line that I want people to get out of it is that Christianity is a brainwashing religion. You may not realize it if you're trapped in it. You obviously, if you're a Christian, you think you know the truth. You think you have the truth. There's no question about it, because the one thing Christianity does well is it solves the sin problem that no other religion can solve. Although I demonstrate in my book that it actually fails to do so, but I won't deal with that here. You can read the book if you're interested. But in one sense, it does. And so because of that, you think you're the only right religion. And that's one thing that Christianity also does well, is it is it claims this is the only right religion. All the other religions are wrong because Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except by me. And so this is it. Whereas, you know, all the other religions are like, oh, we'll accept, you know, it's okay. Everybody can just all get along and they don't care. Like, it's just like every religion's fine. Whereas Christianity is like, no, we're it. It's Jesus or the highway. And so I understand where you are. I was there. What I would challenge you to do is read the book, because unlike what I have observed from books that I have seen in the atheist world or in arguing against Christianity, is that instead of taking the approach of trying to just destroy all of your views by arguing all of the finer points of atheism and all the negative points of Christianity, I've really taken a different approach in this book. When I write a book, I don't like to just reinvent the wheel. I don't like to just rewrite what everybody else has written because it's already done. And most people do it better than me anyway. So this is a very unique approach in that instead of attacking, I take the positive approach and I say, let's take a look at what Christianity is. Let's take a journey through faith and let's see, what are all the positive things about Christianity? Let's see if they actually stand up to scrutiny. Let's discuss why you actually believe and see what happens at the end of this book. Mm-hmm. And so I take you on a large journey of removing the brainwashing that makes you think Christianity is what you think it is. So I guess my challenge is, if you're a Christian and you think that this book could not deconvert you, take the challenge, test your faith, see if actually it will have an effect on you. If it doesn't, worst case scenario is you're going to learn a lot of good arguments against atheists. So there's a real positive part to it. And you should come out on the other side a lot stronger in your faith. If you're an atheist or anybody else reading or in a deconversion process, or whatever, this book will help you out as well. As Miguel said, he enjoyed the book. There's a lot of great things in there you're going to learn. It's vast. It's like 420 pages. So there's plenty of information in there for anybody who reads it. But anyway, I hope that's what you were looking for. That's my plug for the book. But by all means, go to Amazon and grab it. How to Kill God, the Easy Way.
The Easy Way. Sorry, I missed that one, or I got stuck on the first one because it was so provocative. Yeah, 400. But God, I read it. It was a good read because it seemed like a nice sitting down two evening reading session. So it was a good read. And do you have a website?
I do. It's howtokillgod.com.
Okay, I'll put that in the show notes, whether you're on YouTube or the audio version. So check it out. Yeah, good book. And yeah, everybody, thanks for the super chat. Thanks for being here. We're not done with live shows. Tomorrow, Alan Burke will join us from Ireland to discuss apparitions at the moment of death, where he puts all these visions of people who see ghosts during times of stress. And yes, as Robert Connor argued, Jesus might have been just a reworked ghost story because he appeared to these people in pain. Well, we'll have plenty tomorrow about that. And then next week, we got some OGs, including Dr. Rick Straussman and Gary Sukoff. So good stuff on the way. But we must end this. Vance, thanks for keeping us company.
No problem. I guess there must be something to what Alan's saying, because his website is still up. If God existed, he would have immediately deleted his DNS entry.
Giving it a plague.
Good point.
So awesome. Well, Alan, we appreciate your time, and we appreciate your book, and good luck with everything, and thank you for coming on the show. Appreciate that.
No, thank you. This was absolutely delightful. I really appreciate the time. It was fun.
Yeah, that's it. We gotta have fun. We can't be dour here. For everyone else, yeah, I hope you have a good rest of the weekend, and we will see you tomorrow. And as I always say, yeah, write your own gospel, live your own myth, and have fun killing God. We'll talk soon. Take care, everybody.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today,
experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.